Okay, we're recording. This would not be the first time that we have a difference between Ashkenazim and Sfardim as far as the Haftorah. In fact, earlier on, Parshas Vayishlach, there are some differences even amongst Ashkenazim as far as what the Haftorah should be, Vayetze and Vayishlach. But most Haftorahs are consistent with both Ashkenazim and Sfardim. But here is really a significant difference because Sfardim actually has the Haftorah for this Shabbos a double. It's the same as the Haftorah of the first of the 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. If it's not a leap year, it's the Haftorah of Pinchas. If it is a leap year and Matos and Maaseh are separate, it's the Haftorah of Matos. So it would not be the only time where we say the same Haftorah twice a year. Some years we do it three times a year, depending on how Shmini Atzeres falls. But the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah and Parshas Bahaloscha is also the same Haftorah. Anyway, Yirmiyahu Perek Aleph is a profoundly different connection than the Ashkenazic minhag of what to lay in as Haftorah. I must admit that the Sephardi Haftorah is much more compelling, much more interesting, and I much prefer to learn that with you this evening, because the Ashkenazic Haftorah, while it may be philosophically more compelling, it's just a very difficult Haftorah. And when I say philosophically, it is Yeshayahu's rendition of what will happen to Egypt in the future, right? There are three very large Nevi'im Lagoyim, Yeshayahu, chapter 13 through about chapter 28, Yirmiyahu, chapter 45 through 51, and Yechezkel, chapter 25 through about 35. So these prophets spend these prakim describing in a series of prophecies what's going to happen to a whole host of goyim in the future. And all three of them treat Egypt. Not all three lists are consistent. Some lists have some nations that the other two don't have. So there are some nations that are covered by all three. And Egypt, of course, is one of them. So according to Ashkenazic ritual, we will this Shabbos read Yeshayahu's picture of what will happen to Egypt in the future. Next week, we will read Yechezkel's picture of what will happen to Egypt in the future. And the week after Parshas Bo, we will read Yirmiyahu's picture of what will happen to Egypt in the future. So another compelling reason why I'd rather learn about Yirmiyahu is because we're going to get our fill of what's going to happen to Egypt in the future the next 2 weeks, right? You'll forgive me if I give you a respite from what Yeshayahu has to say about Egypt. Frankly, I'm a little more interested in terms of what Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel have to say because Yeshayahu's prophecy is well into the future. Okay? The Egyptian predictions, I must say, while we're on the subject, very different pictures in the commentaries of how to understand these things. Some pshat commentaries like Ibn Ezra say that these prophecies happened at the time of the Babylonian conquest of Egypt. Or possibly in some Greek conquests of Egypt. However, you have commentaries like Abarbanel and some modern commentaries who find references to the Six-Day War in these prophecies. They find references to what's happening in Egypt now in these prophecies. Okay, I'm just putting it out there. Okay, so there is a different focus between Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel. I should say Yeshayahu, Yechezkel, Yirmiyahu for the order of the three Haftorahs in terms of how to deal with Egypt. But I will leave that for the next 2 weeks. And I would rather now go into our Sephardic brethren connection, which is Yirmiyahu chapter 1. The connection is obvious, is that chapter 1 of Yirmiyahu has God appointing that prophet to speak to the people. That prophet originally demurs. God convinces the prophet, and the prophet goes about his mission. Of course, this connects to chapter 3 and chapter 4 of Parshas Shmos, where God appoints Moshe for the mission. Moshe at first demurs, then both of them make some kind of similar statement that they are unable to articulate the message properly to people. And then God convinces them either by saying, either by actually touching Yirmiyahu's lips, we'll see in a moment, right? God touches his lips and says, I have put my word in your mouth, now you'll be a different man. According to the story in the Torah reading, Hashem reveals, this is Ramban's Mahalach, Hashem reveals to Moshe three signs whereby something turns to something else and then turns back to the thing itself. Rashi wants, it's not enough for Rashi. Rashi wants the actual sign to have some kind of message. Because according to Ramban, it could be a tuna sandwich turning into a falafel and then back into a tuna sandwich. It could be a frog turning into a mouse and then back to a frog. Rashi says, I get that part of it, but he thinks that it should be something that has a message. The snake has a message. The leprosy has a message. You getting it? The blood has a message. There's something behind it. Okay? But back to the Ramban, is that if A is turning to B and then back to A, right? The flesh is turning to... Thanks so much. Boy, was I thirsty. Okay, so... Maybe after. So Moshe, what message was Moshe being given about his inability to articulate God's message? Is that Moshe, if you feel that for the past 60 years or so that you have become a humble shepherd who's incapable of speaking before kings, Moshe, you're a smart guy. Don't you realize now why you were born into the palace, why you were raised a king? Right? Don't you see it now? Okay, so that your situation should reveal itself, that you can return to talking to kings, even though you fell out of practice, in your opinion. Okay, Rashbam's explanation of Kvad Lashon is, I don't speak the language, you get it? Not my tongue is heavy. I don't speak the language well. So Hashem said, don't worry, Moshe, I'll get you I'll get you some anupan, and you'll catch up. You don't really lose your ability to speak your first tongue, right? So that was Hashem convincing Moshe, and Hashem convincing Yirmiyahu. Also, they share some other things in common. They both gave prophecy for exactly 40 years. Moshe from the age of 80 to the age of 120. And Yirmiyahu, really, precisely. It says he started Nevuah in the 13th year of Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu ruled for 31 years. So that's 18. Another 11 years under Yehoyakim. Another 11 years under Tzidkiyahu. And there's your 40. It's true that there were a few more months in between, but that from the beginning of Maseches Rosh Hashanah gets swallowed up in the kings. So Yirmiyahu ruled gave prophecy for 40 years, as did Moshe. Yirmiyahu gave Tochacha, as did Moshe. But the first Rashi in Yirmiyahu has Yirmiyahu complaining. He says, God, wait a second. It's not fair. Moshe gave Tochacha after proving himself, after parting the sea, after freeing his people, after going 120 days without eating, and still they gave him a hard time. Still they tried to stone him. Right? Me? Who are you telling me? I'm a little kid. Who am I? It's not the first Rashi, it's on Pasuk Yud. I'm not, who am I? Why should they listen to me? And I'm supposed to give them tochacha? It's one thing if you want me to go out there and give them peachy, creamy, rosy-colored sermons. Even that's difficult for me because I don't speak well. Or yadati daber ki nara nochi. Ain li koach hamalitza, like the Al-Sheikh says. Ain kedai lohochi chan, as Rashi says. Right? The Al-Kud Shimoni quotes an interesting medrash that when Yirmiyahu said, I'm just a na'ar, lo yadati daber ki nara nochi, the Yalkut puts in Yirmiyahu's mouth, you know, God, they killed their prophets. They killed Zechariah. They killed Yeshayahu. Right? There's a tradition that Yeshayahu Navi was killed. Right? They called Elisha Baldy. Right? They tried to kill Eliyahu. They killed, you know, look, they ruined their prophets. Why are you giving me this life? What does this have to do with Nar Anochi? So Nar Anochi, perhaps because he's saying, God, I haven't lived yet. I'm just a Nar. I'm just a kid. Let me live a little before they kill me. Right? And they did try to kill him numerous times, but Hashem promised him in this Haftorah that they will try, I won't let them. Okay? I want to read the Haftorah inside with you, please. And I leave you for the moment with a Chiddush. Okay? There is a book by a great scholar. His last name was Gagni. And he wrote a book called Ashkenazim Usfardim. And there's another book called Keser Shem Tov. Oh my goodness, who wrote the... it's going to come to me in a second. Also, it's a 6-volume work on all the differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. And these two books both posit that the Ashkenazim and Sephardim broke off as natural tendencies away from the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. In other words, the two Talmuds created these two communities. And the Yerushalmi became the Sephardim, and the Bavli became the Ashkenazim. This is not to say that Jews from Iraq were all Ashkenazim. No, most were Sephardim years later. But be that as it may, what's interesting is that there are two, in addition to two Talmuds, there's really, there's two Mechiltos. I can only really point to one major Tanaic work, even before the Talmuds, where you have these two offshoots that should really be one. Why should we have two mechiltas? The mechilta is the first medrash halacha to the Torah. Of course, it's to say for Shmos. There is none to say for Bereishis because Bereishis doesn't have any halacha. So the mechilta, of course, should start with Hachodesh Hazelochem Rosh Chodeshim, which it does according to the mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael. But there is a mechilta of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, which follows the general hermeneutic principles of Rabbi Akiva, because he was Rabbi Akiva's student, as opposed to Rabbi Akiva's bar Plukta, Rabbi Yishmael, who lived in Bavel, and Rav Shimon bar Yochai lived in Israel. And the mechilta of Rav Shimon bar Yochai starts with God talking to Moshe at the Sneh. And what it means is that the Sfardim want to concentrate in Parshas Shmos to Moshe's personal relationship with God, while the Ashkenazim want to concentrate in Sefer Parsha Shmos to the nation's communication with God, the national connection, which is what Yeshayahu talks about in what the Ashkenazim have as the Haftorah. But the Sfardim have, they're just interested in Yirmiyahu's connection to Moshe, and hence our Haftorah, Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu. Okay? You can imagine that there are creative commentaries even within Chazal who try to detect any connection they can in this first chapter of Yirmiyahu with Moshe Rabbeinu. I gave you a few so far: 40 years, the Tochacha, I can't speak well, I can't articulate. Right, the first two words, Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu, is already a connection that's made in Chazal, is that a book that starts with the word Divrei is like Eila HaDvarim. It's a book of Tochacha. Right? What are the three books of the Tanakh that begin with the word Divrei? Divrei Koheles, Divrei Amos, Divrei Yirmiyahu. Full disclosure, Divrei Nehemiah, but Nehemiah is not its own book, so that doesn't count. So Divrei Yirmiyahu means that it's already telling you its words of Tochacha. Where does this come from? So it comes from when Yosef spoke to his brothers, and the brothers told Yaakov, Diber Eleinu Kashos. He spoke with us harshly. Why is the word Diber, Ledaber, a harsh expression of speech? It's grammatically sound to say so. Because the Hebrew word ledaber almost exclusively in Tanakh appears only in what's known as Binyan Kaved. Also, if any of you went to Flatbush, Binyan PL. Okay? Or Ramaz, maybe. Or Binyan PL, right? As opposed to Aleph Memresh, which not once in the Torah appears in Binyan Kaved, and always appears in Binyan Pa'al, which is also known as Binyan Kal. Kal as opposed to Kaved. You get it? So Aleph Memresh, which is Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Emor, says, right, Lahazir Agdolim Alektanim, is when you speak to kids, you've got to speak softly. Right? Remember I think this came up once in this year. That's the Lashon of Amor. Amor is love, is soft. Amira is to love. Okay? So, Hashem Amircha Hayom in Parshas Kisavo might be the same word. Okay, Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu min haKohanim asher ba'anatot be'eretz Binyamin. So he lived just north of Jerusalem in the city of Anatot. Anatot, you may recall, was the city where the Kohanim were banished. If you lived in Anatot, you were not a working Kohen. First of all, you wouldn't want to live there. It's pretty far from Yerushalayim. Okay, it's north of Ramah. It's getting in, Eretz Binyamin. It's going north of Yerushalayim. His father has a nice Kohanic name, Chilkiyahu. It's a beautiful Kohanic name. In fact, Chilkiyahu happens to be the name of the current, Kohen Gadol. Okay, the Kohen Gadol at this time is Chilkiyahu. And wouldn't you know it, the Targum Yonasan to the first pasuk in this sefer actually says that this was the Chilkiyahu who was the Kohen Gadol, which of course would make Yirmiyahu come from, well, he is a Kohen, that's for sure, but it means that he's coming from a very chash of a family, right? I must disagree. I'm sorry that I'm only disagreeing because I'm agreeing with the Meforshim who disagree. Chas v'shalom, I would never just stam with my own chutzpah disagree with a Targum. But the evidence to the contrary that the Kohen Gadol would never live in Anatot. The Kohen Gadol has to live in Yerushalayim. What are you talking about? Look at Semen HaMikdash. He has to live in Yerushalayim. Why would he send his son to Anatot? Maybe they open up a sniff there, a Megdu Tshuva there, or, open up a Lubavitch center there. I don't know, but it doesn't make sense. Plus, Yirmiyahu never goes to the Beis HaMikdash. The closest he gets to the Beis HaMikdash is in chapter 7 and chapter 26 to say that it's going to be destroyed. Adarabba. In later Prokim, Hashem tells him, go to the Mikdash and deliver this message. And he tells Baruch Ben Neriya, Ani Atzur, I can't go there. You give the message. Either because he was in jail where he was, or because he was persona non grata. No one wants to see Yirmiyahu in the Beis HaMikdash. Right? Okay? So this might have been a different Chilkiyahu then, okay? Do you remember when the Kohanim were banished to Anatot? Right? Remember that God told Shmuel in his first Nevuah when he thought he was talking to Eli that all of Eli's descendants would die young and they wouldn't serve God in his temple, right? So Nebuch, Eli's descendants, made a very ignominious end when Shaul killed 85 families of the Kohanim for helping David, right? You all know what I'm talking about. And then the one Kohen who survived became friends with David. David told him the very famous political statement, whoever wants to kill you wants to kill me, that makes us friends, right? So join me. He became David's Kohen Gadol. But then he made the wrong step in supporting Adoniyahu in the beginning of Malachim Aleph.
Aviatar,
correct. That was the Haftorah we did some weeks ago in Parshas Chayesara, recall, right? Okay. So Aviatar made the mistake of following Adoniyahu. Okay. In a country like this, you vote for the wrong president, he's still your president. But if you in Sefer Melachim, you vote for the wrong king, it might get you in trouble. So Eviatar is banished. Shlomo tells him, go to Anatot and stay there. You will not serve me in my mikdash. And he appointed Tzadok HaKohen to replace him. And then it says, like in parentheses, it's in the text. It's like an editor's note. This was to fulfill the promise God made regarding the house of Eli, that their descendants shouldn't serve as Kohanim. It's very possible, I submit to you, that Yirmiyahu was a descendant of Eli. He's still a Kohen, of course, right? But he is not, I wouldn't call him Mireshe Matras Kohanaya like Targum does. Asher yod dvar Hashem elav bimei Yehoshiyahu ben Amon melech Yudah, mishlosh esrei shana lemalcho, vayi bimei Yehoyakim ben Yehoshiyahu melech Yudah, ad tom ashtey esrei shana letzikyo ben Yehoshiyahu melech Yudah, ad glos Yerushalayim b'chodesh ha-chamishim. I read this so quickly because I just told you this. These are the 40 years, 18 plus 11 plus 11. Why doesn't he mention Yehoyachin or Yehoahaz in his introduction? So I hinted at that before also. Yehoahaz only ruled 3 months. Yehoyachin only ruled 100 days. So as a result of that being such a short time period, he leaves them out of the koteret. All right? They're not mentioned at all in his heading. This is not to say that he doesn't address them later in the book. I will submit to you that in chapter 22, Yirmiyahu addresses both Yehoyachin and Yehoahaz. Right? Yehoyachin by name, Yehoahaz by hint, or when Yirmiyahu mentions a king by the name of Shalom, ring a bell, Shalom, an unknown person in Sefer Melachim. There's no king by the name of Shalom who rules, but Yirmiyahu in chapter 22 addresses a Yehuda king named Shalom. Who is he? Right? So I submit to you, he's Yehoahaz. Right? The proof is in the Pasuk in Divrei Yomim, but that's for another time. So, Vayi Dvar Hashem Elai Lemor, my first Nevuah. Okay? A bit of a Chiddush. Look through, if you have a chance, if you have some spare time tonight, open up a Tanakh and just read through. Go through, turn 50 pages. Okay? Yirmiyahu has a lot of chapters, you know, the openings, psuchos, parshios, right? Just look, it'll take you, you can do it in less than 5 minutes. And you can look and you see that this prophet says these five words more than any other prophet. Vayi Dvar Hashem Elai Lemor. A lot. Okay? A lot. Not 15, 20 times. It's all over. But he also sometimes says, Vayi Dvar Hashem Lemor, without saying a lie. It's a big chiddush to say that there's a qualitative difference between the two. Okay, I'll tell you just while standing on one foot, that some commentaries say that when it says, Vayish Dvar Hashem Elai, that it's a direct prophecy from God to Yirmiyahu. When he leaves out the word Elai, Baruch Ben Neriah is in the middle of things. Okay, Baruch Ben Neriah was Yirmiyahu's Talmud, and the Rav Muvhak of whom, according to Chazal, do you remember? He was the Rebbe of Ezra HaSofer. If you're the Rebbe of Ezra HaSofer, that's enough of a claim to fame. Okay? Ezra and Yirmiyahu being two of the three people that Chazal say were like Moshe. Ezra, Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Beis, the Gemara compares to Moshe in five or six different ways. Yirmiyahu, I just gave you three or four. The third one is
Shmuel. Third one is Shmuel, right?
Shmuel. Well, correct. Moshe v'Aaron v'Kohanav, u'Shmuel v'Korei Shmo, Korei Mel Hashem v'Hu Ya'anein. Or as our own prophet Yirmiyahu says in chapter 15, Im Ya'amod Moshe u'Shmuel l'fonai ein afiyo ha'am hazeh. Even if Moshe and Shmuel would come before me, I wouldn't forgive these people. So Yirmiyahu, I'm not going to forgive them because you're asking, right? So they're a pot. I'm not going to listen to Shmuel. I'm certainly not going to listen to you, right? Okay. So B'terem etzocho b'beten yidaticho, B'terem tetze merechem yitkashticho, Navila goyim nisaticho. So the Navila goyim, I already mentioned to you, right? And Hashem says, before you were even formed in your mother's womb, I knew you. I set you aside to be a Navi. Hashem is trying to preempt him, right? Yirmiyahu, listen, let me hold on. I know you're going to object. You can't. You were born for this. Yirmiyahu is no David. David tries to convince Shaul that he's up to killing the giant. And what does David say? I was born for this. I was waiting for this day ever since I killed that bear and that lion with my bare hands protecting my sheep. I knew I was out for something big, right? Yirmiyahu does not, I'm not saying that David is arrogant, but Yirmiyahu is, it does not have that kind of outlook here, right? So according to the Rambam in the Mor Nebuchim, by the way, today was the Rambam's Yahrzeit. According to the Rambam in the Mor Nebuchim, every Navi, every one of the 48 Nevi'im and the 7 Nevi'ot was chosen before they were born. You can't just wake up and say, I want to be a Navi. Now, you can, but not the 48 and the 7. 48, in other words, Sarah is one of the 7. It doesn't mean that only 6 other women in the whole Tanakh gave Nevuah. No. Rivka was a Nevi'ah too. But she was not one of the 7, because in order to be in the 7, you have to not just have a predilection of the future. You have to be giving announcements in the future. You have to say, Ko Amar Hashem. Where did Sarah do that? She sure did when she told Avraham that God's favored is Yitzchak and not Ishmael. Right? And God told Avraham to listen to Sarah. Okay? Chazal say that Leah and Rachel were also Nevios. They knew how many children that Yaakov was going to have. They knew how many of each one. You know, that's like Nevuah. But it's not this 48 and 7. So if Yirmiyahu is obviously one of those 48, why does Hashem only tell Yirmiyahu this? So the Rambam writes in the Mor Nebuchim, because Hashem knew that Yirmiyahu would object, so he preempted him. Get it? Yirmiyahu, listen, I know you're about to say you're not up to this, but Yirmiyahu, you were born for this. And still Yirmiyahu objects. So the Radak asks an obvious shaila on the Rambam. Yirmiyahu was not the only prophet who objected. Why didn't Hashem tell this to Moshe at the burning bush? Or to Yonah? How about Yonah? Why not start off his message to Yonah? Yonah, you were born for this mission, right? And then let the chips fall where it may. Mm-hmm. Okay, anyway, the answer that the Radak gives to this is that Moshe was more sophisticated. Moshe was 80 years old at this time. Yirmiyahu was maybe 12, 14, 16, maybe even 18. He's a na'ar. He's a kid, right? Plus, there's a qualitative difference. Moshe very much wants the prophecy to be given. Moshe very much wants Bnei Israel to be taken out of Egypt. It's just that he feels that he's not the right man. You see, God did tell Moshe it's going to get worse before it gets better, right? At the end of chapter 3, Paro won't let you go. I'm going to have to use the Yad Chazakah. I'm going to have to use miracles, right? So what, if Moshe knew that, if he was so smart, the Radak says, why did he go kvetching to God in chapter 5?
Since I've come, more people are dying. And there was a man who didn't make enough straw, and he had 6 kids, and they clubbed him to death. And if I never came, he'd still be alive. Why are you making me do this?
Now, God, according to the Medrash, liked it that Moshe behaved this way. He wanted Moshe, you know, I like this. I want you to get agitated for your people. I want you to love them. I want you to fight for them. I want you to tear down mountains for them. Right? So this would be my answer for Moshe. Not that he needs my, backing or anything, but so that Moshe was telling Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm not upset with your plan. I know what your plan is. You told me you have a plan. It's going to get worse before it gets better. That's fine. And I'm going to teach that plan to the people. My objection is that when the people are talking about why life is getting worse for them, ever since I came, I haven't been able to convince them that it's because of God's plan. The word on the street is that it's gotten worse for them because of
me,
my incompetence.
Right.
I go up to the king and I say, code. Why did you make me say letters that are so hard to pronounce for someone with stuttering? Pakod Yifkod? Come on, that's a tough word to say, right? So I don't know if Moshe actually stuttered, but be that as it may, I mean, you know, God, the reason why things got worse is because of my incompetence. And that's what I was telling you at the SNES. And our own. They're better people than me. Right? Okay. So Yirmiyahu might have the same sentiment, but at least Moshe wants the thing to be done. He wants Bnei Yisrael to leave. God, we've been waiting for this for a long time. But Yirmiyahu said, God, what's in it? What am I gonna do? I'm gonna tell the people that they're, I mean, this is just not, it's not gonna work. Right? I'm gonna rush into their places of iniquity, and I'm gonna tell them that they should let slaves go free. And who's gonna listen to me? Right? I don't have a reputation. I haven't done anything, right? I haven't done anything in their eyes. I haven't even been I haven't even taken a speech course, right? So Vayomer Ahad Noy Elohim Hinei Lo Yadati Daber Kinara Nochi. I went over the different perushim to these words before. Vayomer Hashem Elai Al Tomar Nara Nochi. Don't you say so? Ki Al Kol Asher Shlachacha Teleich Ves Kol Asher Atzavecha Tadaber. You're going to do everything I say. Al Tirami Pnehem Ki Tchani Latzilcha Neum Hashem. Latzilcha. Don't be afraid of them. Because I will be with you. You have to be a bronze wall before them. Okay, an iron wall. Just stand up for them to them with chutzpah. Like the Shulchan Aruch says, Az Kaname, Ratzka Tzvi, Gibor Ka'ari. Right? You've got to be strong in front of them, because if you're weak in front of them, then they'll eat your lunch. Vayishlach Hashem es yado vayaga alpi. God himself, not an angel like in Yeshayahu. God himself stretched forth his hand and touched Yirmiyahu in the mouth. I have appointed you not only for Israel, but for the nations, for kingdoms. Four words for destruction, for the sake of rebuilding. Because if you don't destroy, it's rotten to the core. You've got to open up that filling in the tooth and pull out all of the rotten part and maybe even destroy the temple also. Root and canal. Okay? You've got to just root everything out. Because if you don't, lintosh lintotz labida haros, you will never be able to live nos filintoa. This is known even in halachically. It's known as stira amanas livnos. We know that the 39 melachos of Shabbos, that it has to be creative because it's connected creation. It's connected building the Mishkan, and those are creative acts. If you destroy on Shabbos, it's not a violation of the Torah, right?
Kol makaklin b'turim.
Right, kol makaklin b'turim, except with havara and chabura, But if you destroy something on Shabbos, it's not a positive act. One of the 39 melachos is stira, which means to destroy, to dismantle. The answer is, if it's stira, almanas livno, so comes the Malbim in our pasuk and says that when a Kaddish Baruch Hu does a stira, it's always almanas livnos. There's no such thing as God destroying. God only builds. Okay? All right, it's sort of a little like a Musa moment I said a few weeks ago. I never lose. I either win or I learn. I never destroy. I either build or I rebuild. Okay? So the livnos for the Torah, the Malbim says, is what we call stira almanas livnos. Okay, it works halachically and it works philosophically. Okay? It's like Yeshayahu says in Perek Yud, ki layon charutz shotef tzedakah. It's an utter destruction, but overflowing in righteousness. Okay. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not ever punish us. I want to really say that. I don't mean to be coy. It's never a punishment. Hashem only allows the consequences of our actions to take place. God did not punish us in Ai to lose the second battle in Israel. He just left us to the regular exigencies of war. Had we not been so cocky as to just take 2,000 men and we had 20,000 men instead, we might have won the second war. It's just that because Ochan took from the spoils, God's Shechina was not with us. So that's it. I mean, you know, sometimes the Nevi'im do say God is fighting against you, right? Like some Gemaras in Gittin. Okay, it could be that God lets nature, lets the winds fight against us. I don't know. But I have to say that even when HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes us, it's shotev tzedakah, it's meant to be just opening up the floodgates of consequence. So I know this is philosophically and I'll leave it here. But this the Malbim on Pasuk Yud Ayin Shom, if you'd like. Someone have a question? Okay. So Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayidvar Hashem Elai Lemor. Ma Toroe Yirmiyahu Va'omar Makel Shoked Ani Roeh. God asked me what I see. It's like giving him a test to make him feel good. And, oh, you're getting this right. You're pretty good at this, Yirmiyahu. Look, this is what we do. He shows him a vision. And Yirmiyahu looks at the vision. The Gemara in Chagiga says that Yeshayahu sees one thing. Yechezkel sees another thing. Right? But it's actually the same thing. It's the exact same thing. It's just that their mindset sees it differently and therefore interprets it differently. But from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they saw the same thing. Right? The Gemara says that Yechezkel chapter 2 and Yeshayahu chapter 6, which makes up our Kedusha, Kadosh, 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 and the Baruch Kadosh Hashem in Komo, it was the exact same vision that they had, but their angels presented it differently. By Yeshayahu it's Srafim, by Yechezkel it's Ofanim B'chayos HaKodesh, and Yechezkel made a bigger deal of it because he was the Ben Kfar, and Yeshayahu was the Ben Krach. So the Ben Krach, who lives in the city, sees the king all the time. So, okay, you know, it's still an important event for me, but I'm not going to make as big a deal of it as Yechezkel. So too, Hashem asks Yirmiyahu to see something. Another Navi might have seen it in a different way. So he sees a makel shoked. It's a staff sprouting almonds. The staff means something to beat, something to give musr. What I'm thinking of doing now, I'm going to do quickly. Okay, an important historical side note. The 13th year of Yoshiyahu is the year 627. He started his rule in 640. 627 is a very famous date in the study of Assyriology. Assyriology is the study of the Assyrian Empire, especially the 150 years between 627 BCE and 150 years before that. What happened in 627? The prophecies of Nahum and Habakkuk and Zephaniah came true. Nineveh, this great city, built up even greater than Nebuchadnezzar built up Babel, because Nineveh stood for much longer than Babel. Persians laid waste to Babel much more quickly than Babel laid waste to Ashur. That's why Ashur has left us so much more archaeological data than Babel. That could just be mazel. Maybe all of the Babylonian tablets were destroyed by some of the Persian kings, or maybe in an earthquake or a volcano, or so who knows what. Anyway, Babel, the official date that Assyriologists give for like the what we call the end of the Assyrian Empire is the very first year that Hashem tells Yirmiyahu to address his people. It's actually a time of opportunity, right? The Assyrians, who made our life so miserable for so long, abroch to Columbus, they're coming to see their end, right? So when Hashem says ki shoked ani adri la'sofso, the king who wiped them out was a king named Nabopolassar. Nabopolassar. Yirmiyahu is going to make reference in chapter 25 to the first year of his son Nebuchadnezzar and point out that 70 years from that first year, another nation is going to destroy them. Okay? Chapter 29, he makes a different cheshbon of 70 years from the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, and those two 70s got mixed up, even by Daniel, by Achashverosh, and by Megillah, but you know that they got a little mixed up. Okay. So this when Hashem says ki shoked ani avu lasav so, it's that listen, there are great opportunities if you can convince these people to do tshuva. But Yirmiyahu, you know, people get ingrained in their ways. You know, Moshe knew Paro wasn't going to change all of a sudden. And I want you to know, Yirmiyahu, it's very important. I think it's crucial for us to appreciate this as well. Yirmiyahu's mission was not to save the land, the temple, the monarchy. If that was his mission, he was a miserable failure. His mission was to instill hope in the people that were exiled to return. That is his mission. If no tefillin Torah, not right away, 70 years later. If there's something that Yirmiyahu could have done better, it would have been to convince more people to surrender to the Babylonians, or in the very least, to convince the people not to murder Gedaliah, and even after that, not to go to Egypt. Right? There's like three strikes that messed up the ability of Israel to maintain itself during those 70 years to be more hospitable for people to come back. Right? Okay. There's a bit of a controversial Rashi on this pasuk, where Rashi says, Makel Shoked, the reason why God chose an almond for the Yirmiyahu's first nevuah is because it takes an almond 21 days to fully sprout from the time it begins to bud. So Gemara in Meseches Bechoros, right? Now, there are other fruits in that Gemara that take a month to sprout. Rashi should know better. Rashi should know that it should really be a fruit that takes a month to sprout in this first vision. Of course, Chas v'Shalom, Rashi knows better. Its question is, why did Yirmiyahu use this fruit? And Rashi says, because of the 21 days between the time that the wall was breached and the time the temple was destroyed.
3 weeks.
It's the 3 weeks, right, everybody? What's the problem? Someone tell me the problem.
Nine. It's the ninth of...
The ninth of Tammuz in the Bible.
Right.
The 17th of Tammuz is by Sheni, says the Gemara.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's no date in the Tanakh, 17th of Tammuz. Twice it says in the Bible that the ninth of Tammuz is when the Babylonians broke through. And by the way, full disclosure, the ninth of Av is also not mentioned in the Tanakh.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In Yirmiyahu, it says the 7th of Av, and in Melachim, it says the 10th of Av.
Yeah.
Gemara answers that too. Gemara resolves it that on the 7th, on the 9th of Tammuz, they broke through Jerusalem. They were pillaging and destroying homes and ransacking Jewish properties. And then they finally broke through the Harabayis on the 7th of Av. And then they were pillaging up there for 3 days. And on just before the 10th of Av, they put it to flames. On the ninth. So according to this Mahalach, the fruit that should have been used by Yirmiyahu, if this is the point,
should have been a month.
Should have been a fruit that lasts a month. Which, by the way, does exist in the Gemara, according to the Gemara. Anyway, that's shoked in Hebrew, the shkod means to do something quickly.
Huh. Okay?
Because an almond definitely is the quickest sprouting tree in Israel. That's why we sing about it on
Shabbat.
Surely you all sang that in first grade, right? When they gave you a little bag of buxer and figs and dates and raisins and right. So shaked becomes a verb to do something quickly. So, but here is why I say this is controversial. Is because the Talmud Yerushalmi gives a different interpretation of this of Makel Shoked. Talmud Yerushalmi says that really they broke through on the 17th of Tammuz and by his Rishon, Yerushalmi Tainus. Really they broke through the 17th of Tammuz in the first temple also. So what's the obvious kasha? So why did Yirmiyahu write the 9th of Tammuz?
All right.
Answer? Controversy? Anybody?
They were mixed up.
Yerushalmi says that Yirmiyahu had such difficulty keeping records. Look at his book. The book is so out of whack and so out of order that Yirmiyahu had trouble keeping the records. And he got the date wrong. Ezra knew it was wrong, but allowed it, you know, Ezra did some editing work and allowed it to remain to let people know that Yirmiyahu was writing this book like in jail and in the great harrowing circumstance, and read to chapter 36 and 38, and he was mamish running for his life in the middle of writing all this. Right, with Baruch Ben Neri a little in the mix. Okay. All right, so I found a few other Ashkenazic Meforshim from the school of Rashi who also seem to say the same thing, but I will leave that for now. Okay. This is the third time Hashem is talking to Yirmiyahu. But Shenis meaning the second vision. I see not a bubbling pot. That would be Sir Nofeach, like in Yeshayahu, Eish Nofeach Pechom. But Sir Nafuach means from the Lashon Vayipach Ba'apav, Bravanel says, that it is a cauldron that's just starting it's not boiling. No, that means that the fire has been under there for a long time. It's a cauldron where they're taking bellows to blow, you know, you have to get the fire moving. Sir Nafuach means that the fire is just starting to be lit. Okay? Because the problem with Bovel is just starting now. Yirmiyahu is making an amazing claim right now. He's saying that there is a young man in Bovel, his name is Nebuchadnezzar, he's the son of the king. Yirmiyahu, if you could get the people to do tshuva, let the slaves free, return land to its original owner, call out to me as if though I'm really their yotzer and I'm really their maker. I'm really hitting you now with different haftorahs of the year. And get them to see the light. That young child, that young Nebuchadnezzar will die on fall of his horse and die. I mean, I'm making this up, of course, but I'm just saying that Yirmiyahu, it's a sir nafoach ufanav mipnei tzafona. There's a bubbling pot. It's facing north. There's a small window of opportunity right now. But every time he grows older, every time another thing happens, every time another milestone, it becomes harder and harder to change the course of history for you to avoid the inevitable. Now, I must point out to you, when Chizkiyahu showed the Babylonians his treasures, God predicted that those same Babylonians will carry off those treasures into captivity. When Menashe, Chizkiyahu's son, engaged in such horrible trespass and turned Israel almost into a polytheistic state, God said already in Sefer Melachim Bet years ago that because of those trespasses, I will not suffer Jerusalem to last much longer. But Yoshiyahu did turn things around, Menashe's grandson. And like I said before, HaKadosh Baruch always waits for us with open arms. It's just that when there's a gzeira like this, it's just much harder to turn it around. But gzeiros for bad can always be turned around. We've learned that rule before. Okay? So the pot facing north is pretty obvious. A cauldron tends to have a spout. Otherwise, a cauldron is round. What faces? There's no facing. It's round. Whatever it is, that means the spout was facing north, right? Because mitzafon tipatach ha-ra'ah al kol yoshvei ha'aretz. From the north shall come all of the bad things, right? Because that is where Bavel is, to the north. Wow. In other words, Bavel is going to unite a lot of smaller Chaldean Kastim states, and all of them are going to come up and set up house by Yerushalayim and just take over. And I'm going to get even with the people for all of them. God gets straight to the point. It's about Zara. Okay? Let them get help from the Avodah Zarah. It's not that God is a jealous spouse. Hashem says that by turning to Avodah Zarah for their help, they turn to the ways of Avodah Zarah. Okay? And Hashem concludes the Haftorah the way Hashem concludes with Moshe. Okay? And while Hashem does not give Yirmiyahu an assistant like Hashem gives Moshe, that assistant is coming up soon. His name is Baruch ben Neria. Okay, we only introduced him much later in the book, but he's around pretty early on. Moshe has an Aharon to speak for him. Yirmiyahu has Baruch ben Neria to write for him. Okay, of course, Moshe was never incarcerated by his people, but Yirmiyahu was incarcerated again and again and again. Right? So Hashem closes off the Haftorah by saying, I read that like Radak. I'll explain in a moment. Hashem says, now gird your loins, stay firm. Don't be afraid of them. Hashem does not scare Yirmiyahu like he tells Yechezkel in chapter 3, that if you don't speak up to them, I will hold you responsible for their moral failings. If they won't listen to you, that's their business, but you have to deliver the message. Don't be afraid of it. Don't be humble. Don't think that they're not going to listen anyway. Someone will listen. You will make differences. Okay? Rav Moshe Feinstein Paskin, that if a rabbi has a shul with 500 members on Rosh Hashanah, and there's a tshuva like this, and he goes, Moshe, and the rabbi said, if I announce that no one should speak during the Kiyah Shofar, from the first Kiyah to the last Kiyah, for 2.5-3 hours, but I see that in my shul, practically no one listens to that. So if I announce it, I'm making them bigger abaryanim, right? Mm-hmm. So isn't it better, mutiv yushogin v'ayu mezidin? Better they should be doing it. So Rav Moshe answered, if even one person, you think one person's going to listen, make the announcement for that one person. Okay? So Hashem tells both of you, Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, there will be those people. You'll make the differences. Okay? So, but here, Radak understands that the end of Pasuk Yud Zayin, Al techas mipnehem, don't be afraid of them, penachitcha lifnehem, because if you are afraid of them, I will cut you down before them. All right? So, I'm warning you, don't be afraid. If you are afraid, I will cut you down by letting them cut you down. Rav Yosef Kara understands it as a flowing statement where pen doesn't mean what it usually means. If you look inside, you'll see. He says, Al techas mipnehem pen achitcha lifnehem. In English, it would translate like this. Don't be afraid lest I cut you down. I would never cut you down. I would never do that, Yirmiyahu. In other words, Yirmiyahu is still getting his first pep talk. So it's like Hashem is not going to say, I'll cut you down if you're afraid. No. Don't be afraid lest I get it's a flowing statement. Don't be afraid lest I cut you down. V'ani hineni saticha yom le'ir mivtzor la'mud barzel l'chomos nechoshes al kol aretz machay Yehuda l'sareha l'chomoneh l'am aretz. I am going to make you a wall of iron before these people. V'nilchamu elecha, I'm sorry to say, Yirmiyahu, your fears are actually correct. They will fight you. V'lo yuchlu lach, but they will not prevail against you. Ki itcha ani neum Hashem lahatzilecha, because I am with you to save you. Remember, at the end of the book, I think I mentioned this, maybe in a different context. Remember that later on in the book, Yirmiyahu begged Tzidkiyahu for almost by this time a fifth or sixth time, surrender, don't fight, don't put up a fight. But the generals all wanted a fight. So Yirmiyahu said, listen, Yirmiyahu, I'm too weak. I cannot stand up to my generals. I'm too weak to be weak. You know, I'm too weak to surrender. So I happen to know that they're going to ask you what you told me. When they ask you that, when you leave this room, do not say that you begged me to surrender, because if you do that, they will kill you. Mm-hmm. In light of the two psukim we just finished our Haftorah with, What did Yirmiyahu tell them when he left the room? And why? There's an important philosophical question here. In light of the promise of these two last two psukim, what should Yirmiyahu tell the men who indeed asked him as soon as he left Tzidkiyahu's room, what did you just tell the king?
The truth. Just tell him the truth. He's not supposed to be afraid.
I think.
Well, he's been promised that by God that he's not going to be able, they're not going to be succeed in killing him.
So here's a very important philosophical notion. I think you're both correct in terms of the philosophy of it, but you're not correct in terms of what Yirmiyahu actually said when he left the room.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
No, you're saying what he should have said. Uh-huh. That's like the high ground, right? Yeah, because he's saying, you know,
over this 3 years.
But Yirmiyahu couldn't say that because then he'd make a lie out of God's promise. In other words, Yirmiyahu said they're about to take a knife to your throat if you tell them that you asked me to surrender. God's promise is not going to put up a wall of marble at his throat. I'm sorry, the world is a natural place. It's natural order. Uh-huh. When God told Shmuel to pour oil over David's head because he's going to be the next king of Israel, he still escaped Shaul's wrath. He did not tell him, like a Clint Eastwood kind of esque statement, go ahead, make my day.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? He still had tachpulot. He still had a strategy to escape and to flee to the Philistines, to flee to the Moabites. You know what I'm saying? It's very easy to say, okay, God promised you're going to be king. Now go become a trapeze artist. You know, go skiing. Go, you know, do dangerous things.
Right.
And take off your mask in public. You know, you're going to be king. No, you've got nature is nature. If Yirmiyahu had said, I begged him to surrender, then they probably would have killed him, and then what would be of God's promise? God's promise inherently is, I will save you, Yirmiyahu. Don't do any stupid stuff. Okay? Now, I don't mean it that way, chas v'shalom, but you know what I'm saying, is that we're human beings. We have to work with God's plan.
Right.
But we have no right to just assume, well, God said that, blah, 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 so therefore I'm gonna walk across tightropes on my head. You know, I'm just saying that the promise to Yirmiyahu is not an unequivocal promise that, you know, you just do your part. You stay safe, do the right thing, don't be afraid of them, stand up to them. But if a king is going to tell you that on the other side of the door is a knife at your throat, if you say, don't be foolish. And Yirmiyahu said, I begged the king not to send me back to jail. Okay? Is it the low road? I think it's philosophically the right road. Because Yirmiyahu says, I have to make sure God's promise is kept. And I have to do my part. The same way that David had to make sure God's promise is kept. Okay, Chevra, that is our connection to Moshe Rabbeinu. Yirmiyahu starts off in a very, very different beginning because he's young. He's not proven, right? Moshe is starting over to be sure. Right, but he has. Remember the Ramban I said in the beginning about A turning to B, turning back to A. Yirmiyahu has no A to turn back to. Right. Okay, but the Sephardic tradition does connect, as we've been saying, to the point of the objection and then the convincing that this is the right thing for you to do. Now go ahead and do it. And then we see that when God told Moshe in Parshas Shoftim, I am appointing a Navi just like you, Moshe, right? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Medrash says it's Yahushua, of course, Shmuel, Yirmiyahu, and Ezra. Interesting, the Medrash does not say Eliyahu, because Eliyahu bitterly complained against Bnei Israel in the rare Haftorah of Pinchas when it coincides, Kano Kanesi. But Yirmiyahu, I would say Yirmiyahu, not every single prophecy of Yirmiyahu's is balanced to his people. Look at chapter 12 if you have a chance. But on the overall balance, he is what's called Tovei Ala'av and Tovei Ala'ben, as opposed to the extremes of Yonah, who's Tovei Ala'ben, and Eliyahu, who's Tovei Ala'av. Yirmiyahu is Tovei Lishneihem, like Moshe. Okay? All right, Chevra, so Yirmiyahu gets to be one of them. And I just want to tell you an interesting statistic. I have taught a course called Great Biblical Personalities at YU for about 20 years. I've taught it, I think, over the years about 8 or 9 times to what amounts to about 200 students. Okay, maybe a little more. Mm-hmm. And the last question on the final in every course of Great Biblical Personalities is, which biblical personality do you admire the most and why? And you can't get it wrong. Mm-hmm. Which personality do you admire the most and why? And what's amazing is that over these 200 students, over 50%, remember, there are a lot of personalities in the Tanakh. Over 50% has chosen Yirmiyahu. It may be because of the way I taught it, maybe, I don't know, but over 50%, that's amazing. Okay, that's our Haftorah this Shabbos, but you have to daven with Leon if you want to read it, okay?
But I'm davening at Young Israel because it's too small, the Sephardic congregation. I'm not comfortable there with the...
Okay, all right, fair
enough. I'm davening Ashkenaz, what can I say?
Okay, so who else is here, Sephardi? No Sephardim here? Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm sorry. All right. Leah Mizrahi, hi. Okay, Leah, I hope that you get to read about Yirmiyahu this Shabbos. And the rest of us, we're going to read Havayim Ashreish Yaakov. Tzav Latzav, Tzav Latzav, Kav Lakav, Kav Lakav, Zer Sham, Zer Sham. That's Yishayahu hearing the complaints of the people, that you just speak to us like little children, a little here, a little there, Tzav Latzav, Tzav Latzav. You give us a command here, a command there. So Yishayahu gets snarky with them. And he goes, you don't like me telling you God's little commands? Right? So, and you, how about if you, this is Hebrew that I'm doing now. So this is, Yishayahu says, if you don't like God's little commands, you're going to be taking big commands from the Assyrians. Okay. In a language you don't understand, even baby language. Okay. All right, Chevra, have a great week.